Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. We all know that part of being alive is risking being hurt and perhaps even being hurt so badly that we're traumatized. Some traumatic experiences are out of the blue. A terrible car accident, for example, or a random act of violence. Even people who witness violence may experience trauma. And then there are the long-suffering kinds of trauma coming from child abuse and war. Tonight, my guest, Megan Nigro, is a practitioner of integrative somatic therapy and body work. She and I will explore the process of recovering from trauma. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Thank you, Elaine.
I'm very glad you could come in tonight. And I was delighted to hear that you are truly a local person. You grew up in our neighboring community of Gustavus.
Yes.
And then, as I understand it, you went back east to University of Massachusetts to study psychology.
I did, in a roundabout way, yep.
In Amherst. And that you have done a lot of traveling.
Yeah.
And during that traveling, you have gotten a lot of training in various modalities.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm interested this evening in really looking at your work, your body work, and specifically the practice of somatic experiencing. So could you give folks an overview of what that means, somatic experiencing? What is it?
So somatic experiencing is a model that was developed by Peter Levine, and it's what they call a biophysiological trauma resolution model, which always feels like a mouthful.
Yeah.
but it really looks at how our physiology and the function of our nervous system is really a huge deal when it comes to trauma. So
yeah.
If we have our biology responding with the fight, flight, and freeze mechanisms whenever we're encountered with an overwhelming stress or trauma, then we need sort of a model that can attend to that. And that's really the design of the model, is working to regulate a nervous system.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a longtime therapist, I recall back around 20, 25 years ago, for the first time, being introduced to the idea that emotions can be held in the body,
mm-hmm.
and not just in the mind.
Right.
And I was back at taking a seminar at Harvard, and it was by Judith Herman, who...
Judith Herman,
yes.
Right.
And working with incest survivors, and really having that introduction that the harm as well as the healing must be holistic. It has to be body-mind. And at that time, I do not think there were modalities introduced to treat that. I know I winged it sort of by bringing in a body worker to work with my group of incest survivors that was sponsored by AWARE. So that was my first introduction, and I was so happy when somatic experiencing came out.
Judith Herman, really, just to say a little more about how she's one of really the... another founding father of the somatic psychology field, really.
I mean, I didn't know that.
Well, just as far as what you're speaking to, all of these were really big advances, right? Like her, I can't remember if it was called a trauma center in Cambridge.
Yeah, in Cambridge.
Yeah. Like, that was really cutting edge work back then. And it still is, really, in a lot of ways. Her respect for how disembodying trauma is, right? Like the dissociative qualities that we have around trauma, right?
Yes.
We call dissociation. No, it's a thing. We dissociate, but we also somatically dissociate. We really leave our bodies, and that's a survival mechanism. And it makes a lot of sense. If you're going to be, you know, eaten by a tiger, you don't want to hang out and feel that. Mm-hmm. So you leave your body. And she did a lot of profound work on educating the entire field to understanding how, yeah, that's a really big deal. The healing of trauma has to be facilitating us being able to sort of re-relate to our bodies.
Well, this is breakthrough stuff. It's not brand new.
No, it's slowly been, you know, it's like an uphill battle in a lot of ways, interestingly.
Right. And
mainstream perspective.
And I remember Levine's book, which I read a long time ago. It had something about tiger.
Waking the tiger.
Waking the tiger. And, you know, some connection to his study of animals. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so he spent, and really was one of the first ones who spent a lot of time looking at animals of prey, and started being really curious about why it was that there could be a gazelle that almost gets eaten by a tiger but survives, and that gazelle will go about normally. It will have its normal herd behaviors. It will sleep with the herd. It will be social. It will eat normally. It's not traumatized. It doesn't exhibit behaviors or symptoms that we associate with, like, PTSD. And so he got really curious about that and started, you know, working with the field of animal study. I'm going to blank on what
and the nervous
called.
Animal behavior, or
there's a better word for it.
Okay, we'll remember later.
We'll remember later. But you know, he really looked at, okay, so if that gazelle is running from a lion and it's running and running and running, and it's got full bore flight physiology, right before the lion actually gets that gazelle, it passes out and it freezes, and the lion gets it and will drag it back to the den and you know, go get her cubs. And in that moment, after the lion drops the gazelle, it actually has its sort of last moment possibility of surviving. So it'll wake up from that freeze and it will bolt. And if there's something standing in the way, then it's in trouble, because it has no orientation. It just wakes up into that full bore sympathetic charge.
So that's the flight.
Yeah, that it was in, right? Like,
yes.
It was running full blast, trying to escape this, and then it passes out, gets caught, and so that's how it wakes up. It drops right back into that full-fledged sympathetic arousal. And then it, like, providing it does run away and succeed in that.
Yeah.
When it gets to a safe, you know, distance, gets a safe distance from the lion, it will tremble and shake and you know, go through some motor program releases, and then it will be fine.
Do all animals tremble and shake when they recover from being bitten or caught?
It's
or mammals. We'll talk about mammals.
I think that's pretty much, I can't.
It's that shiver.
I can't speak for all animals.
Yeah.
But it's one of the sort of principles that they figured out, that, like, they dislodge that energy. And what happens for human beings is we'll have a traumatic, very scary event, and we'll have our freeze mechanism come in. And unfortunately, when we don't have that sort of wake-up moment where we go back into that sympathetic arousal and then discharge that energy, that's not really what happens. Let's say if we're in a car accident and we survive, and the ambulance comes, and we might be strapped down, we might be hopefully we're attended to nicely and humanely, but we might not be. And all of those things continue to inhibit the system, so the freeze stays. And so then what we have ultimately resulting in all these, a lot of these trauma symptoms are this sort of gas pedal and brake on at the same time. We have the sympathetic charge of trying to, you know, fight, flight our way out of something, and then we have that freeze mechanism that comes on, and it kind of overlays everything, and it does have some nice numb-out dissociative qualities that, you know, really serve us in a lot of ways, but it's hard to go through life with that because ultimately that's, it's not a comfortable place to live when you're living in your survival physiology.
Okay, so you're saying that we human beings tend to freeze and we get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, like, what would be a sign that somebody was stuck?
So we can kind of look at the underpinnings, like the physiological underpinnings of behavioral health, right? So depressive disorders can be likened to this freeze response, and they have that infrastructure of the freeze underneath them. And anxiety disorders can be likened to the more sympathetic charge responses of the fight-flight mechanism. So there's that behaviorally that shows up. And then, you know, there's also plenty of more physical disruptions that come as far as symptoms.
Illness.
Yeah, literal physical illness. I mean, that's what the ACE study is all about.
Right, and just to explain, the ACE study is adverse childhood experiences, and, you know, quickly, and this really supports the somatic experiencing work, is that the more traumatic, difficult life experiences a kid has growing up, the greater the rates of illness, and you could call that somaticizing.
Yeah.
I was impressed. I was kind of going to be critical. A couple of years ago, I had an ACE expert on my show, and uh-huh. just critical things. Oh, well, did they control for smoking? And they actually controlled for smoking.
Yeah.
And so even if, you know, they took all the, it wasn't just because ACE people smoke more or that they're more overweight. It just,
it was an amazing study.
It's an amazing study. And so back on all the symptoms, it could be run of the mill. It could be heart disease. It could be depression.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed, because I worked a lot with incest survivors, and I noticed a couple of things that not everybody has. You know, can't just say everybody has this symptom. Often very quiet voices and kind of closed in, like they were still scared that they were going to be hurt. And this would be completely, really pronounced in middle-aged women. You know, if a young woman comes in, or a young girl, you know, she's shy. But just a timidity that I would notice simply seemed to be across the board, that was more than just a personality shyness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we're talking about various kinds of trauma,
mm-hmm.
The single incident trauma of a car accident,
mm-hmm.
The long drawn out trauma of war or
mm-hmm.
child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine it would be, I mean, how would people who, I know you have a very busy private practice and you work with a lot of clients. Do you call them clients?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you work with a lot of clients.
Mm-hmm.
So how do people find you, and how do they know that this is what they need? What happens?
People find me in a lot of different ways. You know, part of that's just small town Juneau.
Yeah.
I do have a website, but a lot of the folks that I work with are also working in a psychotherapeutic relationship. So they've been, you know, working and making, you know, great headway in their progress in their psychotherapeutic process. And there can be these, like, missing pieces of, like, I can't get to this thing, and this
yeah.
thing is still
yeah.
kind of plaguing me. And often with that, there's this physiological underpinning that we're talking about. Like, well, if the system is just in this sort of relentless fight response or this relentless freeze response,
yeah,
then that's gonna be in there as the person's internal experience. So that's often, it's a referral base that we often work with.
Mainly from psychotherapists.
From other psychotherapists or nurse practitioners. Or,
sure.
Yep.
So you could get stuck in the fight mode too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any time freeze kind of comes in, there's things that get stuck.
Uh-huh.
So,
you could be stuck in anger?
Yep. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
What kind of training did you get? How does one train to work with somatic experiencing?
So the Somatic Experiencing Trauma Institute offers professional trainings all around the globe, actually. Yep, they're all over the place. And it is designed as a professional development course, so it's over a 3-year period, and you have 3 modules each year, and
it's a lot of training. I'm going to ask you one more question about it after we have a little music break.
Okay.
So John and Dolly are going to pick out some maybe classical guitar, and we'll have a few minutes, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
more about the dysregulated nervous system. You know, it's kind of hard for us lay people to understand that, okay? So, I know that you travel a lot, training, giving, being, participating in trainings. Is that correct? So you're sort of the now a trainer yourself or a training assistant?
No, I'm an assistant, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a trainer.
And so then you have to explain this to people who are training to be body workers and psychotherapists working with somatic experiencing.
Yeah, usually the trainers have to explain it, actually. But.
Okay. Are you the one that demonstrates it?
How will we just talk about it?
Okay, let's just talk about it. Can you try to explain this the idea of these symptoms coming from a dysregulated nervous system and how, what do you do in somatic experiencing that heals this or brings people back to their old self?
Regulation.
Self-regulation.
Well, so the sort of dysregulation is the term we've used to describe when survival physiology is on board and it's stuck. Because survival physiology, you should actually only be living in survival physiology in the moments of survival, right? So when you're fleeing, when you're fighting off, when you're, you know, and then it should be done. But we live our life in it instead, and that's, like we were talking about the ACEs, that's a lot of stress on your body, all the stress hormones that are, you know, being cranked through your system inappropriate to the environment that you're in, right? You're not actually in a dangerous situation, but your physiology is responding as though it is. Okay. So that's what we call dysregulated. Whereas a regulated nervous system is innately, responding to its environment. So if you're in a safe, relaxed environment, you're going to feel relatively safe and relaxed. Things are going to be calm. If you're needing to get pepped up and your sympathetic mojo is going, then that's there too. And if you need access to your survival physiology, that's also available, right? If you need to fight, then mm-hmm. you can fight. If you need to flee, you can flee.
Okay.
So that's the sort of difference between a regulated system and a dysregulated system. And again, where we were talking about the ACE study, what the ACE study shows essentially is that if we are growing up in these adverse child experiences, we're growing up in survival physiology.
Yeah.
And that actually affects our developmental process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because once again, we're not supposed to have to do that.
No.
We're only supposed to have to do that for, you know, a moment.
Yes.
So, and our nervous system that we're born with is not a fully constructed nervous system, right? Like it itself is actually growing and forming all of its little ways in the developmental process. So in the relational process of, you know, the primary caregiver cooing and mirroring and eye contact and healthy attachment and bonding, all of that is facilitating the development of our nuanced regulated systems, which is we haven't really talked about it yet, but the polyvagal theory, which is this theory that we don't just have the parasympathetic and sympathetic. We have two branches of the parasympathetic, and one of those branches is this branch that's responsible for the nuanced regulation of our system. And that's the 12th cranial nerve, and it, you know, it supports our digestive process, it supports our heart, it supports all of our social engagement muscles and our inner ears and how we attune to human voice and judge safety and tone and prosody and all of that. So all of that's developing as we're developing. Mm-hmm. And if we're suffering these adverse child experiences that are pushing us into the far ends of our nervous system survival response, so into the far end of sympathetic arousal or into the far end of freeze, then we're not able to, gain access and have that regulated piece of our system develop. Does that make sense?
Makes absolute sense. I was very interested in the work that has been done on with PTSD and our returning soldiers from whether it's World War One, World War Two, or current conflicts. And one thing that makes sense is that two soldiers can experience the same traumatic event and come out of it very differently. And it's the soldier who has had the most difficult early life experiences compared to the soldier who had a solid upbringing. The soldier with the weaker, more dysfunctional upbringing is more likely to suffer deeper symptoms. And that makes sense from what you're saying.
Yep.
So really, the higher the ACE score, the more likely it is that if you were in an automobile accident, for example,
exactly,
you your reaction would be more intense.
Yep.
It would hurt you more because you have a less solid base that you're coming from of emotional self-regulation. Okay, that does make sense. And I should mention to our listening audience that you are listening tonight to Mind Over Matter, and I'm Elaine Schroeder. And tonight my guest is Megan Nigro, who is a body worker trained in somatic experiencing, which is a trauma resolution process. And what I'm going through with Megan is everything from how the nervous system works and how this new, relatively new psychotherapeutic and body work modality is helping trauma victims and all kinds of trauma victims. Can you give me some of the scope? Hospital illness can be traumatic.
Yeah.
Kind of the scope of trauma that you deal with.
Yeah, and one of the, the scope is one thing, and also just how we, unfortunately, in the English language, the word trauma is really event-oriented.
Yes.
Right? Like we think it's a thing.
One thing.
It's a one thing, and as far as nervous system perspective, it's anything that comes at your system too much, too fast, too soon. Anything that overwhelms your system's ability to integrate it and process it, then you're looking at trauma as far as the nervous system is concerned.
So you can't say, oh, that's not traumatic.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
How each person, it's really in the eye of the beholder. And what
yes.
their history is,
yes.
and how they experience the event.
Exactly.
And that's why I know personally that some people have decided that being a psychotherapist is not their cup of tea. And I think one of the reasons is it's too traumatic for them to listen to the stories.
Yeah.
Because perhaps they themselves have a trauma history.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult. So there could be a range. You could have, the trauma resulting from one-time events, being assaulted, being robbed, being in a fire,
mm-hmm.
Being in a an avalanche, being almost dying, man-made causes. Is there any difference in human-caused trauma versus acts of God? Do you think it's
like natural disaster?
Yeah, like a natural disaster. Do you think there's any difference in the degree, or would it be so personal?
I don't know.
We used to differentiate that, by the way.
Really?
With when I used to give training on PTSD, and human caused violence, essentially, trauma, incest, rape, child neglect, child abuse, had a different traumatic impact, a greater traumatic impact than things that were not associated with deliberate harm.
Yeah. Yeah, and for sure, you know, relationally, that makes sense, right? And as far as even talking about this attachment piece of how we grow up and this part of our nervous system that's responsible for our nuanced regulation, our ventral vagus system, is relational. It's all a piece of our evolutionary biology that, you know, is part of our tribal design, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're the first move towards safety should actually be moving to another person, like reaching out for safety in numbers.
Yeah.
And because we have so much trauma in our society, that's actually often the last place somebody's going to look, because relationally there's so much trauma, right?
Right.
Right.
So if somebody is harmed by a parent, they feel less safe around other human beings.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is sort of the double whammy,
exactly,
because they can't reach out to another human being.
Mm-hmm.
When you do a somatic experiencing treatment, is there any way you can give us a sense of what that's like? Let's say that I have experienced an automobile accident. I'm going to knock on wood so I don't have one now that I said it. And I'm coming to you because I'm afraid to drive. What would happen?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about somatic experiencing and why it's so, like, wonderfully integrated by so many different practitioners of different backgrounds is also because it's not formulaic. It's not like a protocol. We don't, like, do this and do that. Like, the way we work with every person who comes through the door is relational, and it's working with, well, how can we reach your nervous system, right? Like, is it going to be a process of learning to sort of track body awareness? And we'll have conversation and support around tracking what my own body is doing, like noticing what sensationally is going on moment by moment. Or are we going to work with touch? I'm a touch practitioner, so I'm a lot more apt to use touch in my practice than perhaps a psychotherapist would be. So I use that a lot.
Would we talk? Would you find out what was going on? Would we talk a while?
Sure, we'd talk, you know, mostly in regard to just, like, getting comfortable with one another, right? It wouldn't be necessarily the more, like, clinical talk of a history and a trauma history and what's happening. It would be more like, let's, you know, get comfortable with our nervous systems being in the room together,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Like, yeah, feeling safe relationally.
A long time ago, let's see if this relates to somatic experiencing. A long time ago, both my parents died when I was in my early 30s of natural causes. And I had just finally, I'd taken care of my mother. She died of breast cancer. And she was cremated and the funeral was over. And a girlfriend gave me a gift certificate for a shiatsu massage. And, okay, so I had actually never had a massage in my life.
Yeah.
So I was in Seattle, and I went. And I was pretty strung out, to be honest. It was, you know, losing both parents, it was exhausting. I had been living in Nepal. I had to fly in. You know, it was just, like, really exhausting. And so I, you know, laid down and, you know, took my clothes off and a little kimono on, and I laid down. And the minute the massage therapist touched me, I started sobbing. And I remember thinking, I've wasted this whole massage. But I think that's what happened. What would you?
sounds like that's what needed to happen.
Yeah, of course. Mm. I mean, now looking back on it, it was, you know, it was just what I had to slow down, lie down. And at that time, my husband was still in Nepal. Mm. So I was all alone. Mm. And it was a lot. Aww. I just needed a hug.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just really kind of, you know, when someone has, you know, I almost think this, correct me if I'm wrong, Megan, but it's almost like improvisational music. You're totally trained. You're a totally trained musician. Mm-hmm. So you've been trained classically. You've got it all down. And, you know, truly this is what psychotherapy is too. You've got all this training. And then each person that comes in is unique, and you use the modalities that you know and the wisdom you hope you have gathered to use these properly in a unique way with the individual.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of how it worked.
Kind of how it worked.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is another wonderful time because we're almost done. So let's take a short music break. And we will be back soon. You're listening to Mind Over Matter. I'm Elaine Schroeder. I'm in the studio with Megan Nigro, who is a body worker trained in somatic experiencing, which is a trauma resolution process. And we're going to hear some beautiful music and be back shortly. And I am talking with Megan Nigro, a Juno-based practitioner of integrative somatic therapy and body work. Megan, this is such a new way of dealing with trauma. And let's just use one example of some therapy, psychotherapeutic work I've done in the past, and most therapists have, which is attachment disorder, people who just did not have a strong attachment with a caretaking figure when they were growing up. So how was it treated? How is it traditionally treated compared to like how somatic experiencing would deal with it?
Well, because I'm not a clinical, I'm not a psychotherapist, so I can't speak for how exactly a lot of psychotherapists might treat.
But we don't do body work, that's for sure.
Generally speaking, there's been a lack of attention to, again, this physiological underpinning. So if you're looking at attachment disorder, which fundamentally is this inability to bond, where you have a child that's not bonding with the primary caregiver. But if that child is in survival physiology, meaning in fight, flight, or freeze, they can't bond from there. Like I kind of keep saying the same thing, but it's that physiological infrastructure.
Yes.
You can't get there from there.
Okay.
You can't bond if you're in fight, flight, or freeze. It's a different underpinning. So in order for us to bond, we need, again, what we were talking about earlier, we need that ventral vagus system online, which is that part of our nervous system that's developing in those early times with the mirroring and the cooing and the eye contact, and all of that's developing this part of your nervous system that's responsible for our social engagement process. And that's where we bond. So if we're pushed, again, if the child's been pushed into those outer edges of their survival physiology, the outer edges of their nervous system, they can't form bond from there. So the sort of piece that's been left out in treating attachment disorder through the psychotherapeutic process is that we've got to figure out how to support their nervous systems to come into this more regulated state.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, then they can make some real relational advances. And I know that there are people out there doing amazing work with that, right? Like, and it might not always have, the model somatic experiencing involved, but with the overall growth of somatic work and trauma work and the understanding, this more poignant understanding that's infiltrating the mainstream approaches of nervous system function has a lot to do with what we see as behavior, right? Like when we see behaviors that we're, trying to change, there's a physiological underpinning to that behavior.
Right.
If it's a fight response, if it's a freeze response, if it's a flee response, right? We're going to see
mm-hmm.
all of that manifest in behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a shift in the field that's in the right direction, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And how wonderful that we have this in Juneau, because sometimes we don't get specialties here.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of amazing work. Somatic experiencing is one model. Organic intelligence is another model. There's just been a lot of expansion out of these original models. We were talking about Judith Herman, trauma-sensitive yoga that came out of the Trauma Institute in Brookline that's run by Bessel van der Kolk. Judith Herman's work is really foundational in the design of trauma-sensitive yoga.
Well, I also think of Bessel van der Kolk, who is one of the most respected trauma experts in our field.
Yeah.
And his big breakthrough was arguing with the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual people. He was very brave because he said, we cannot look at PTSD like some war-related single incident trauma, the kind of PTSD that kids will encounter growing up abused and neglected, is of a different order. And he really fought for that distinction.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And he was way out there on the edge in those days. Maybe I've been out of the field a little since I'm retired. Is it coming around?
He's still been fighting for complex trauma, I think is the term.
That's it, complex trauma.
Yeah.
And when you're growing up in a violent, unsupportive family, the trauma is complex because you have brain damage, not because you bumped your head, but because the growing brain doesn't grow properly when it's in a highly stressful situation.
Right. Yeah, and just as far as a local point on this, Josh, I think his name's Joshua Arvidsson. I might be messing up his last name, but he's up in Anchorage and has been doing a lot of work following the Brookline Trauma Center, Bessel van der Kolk's trauma center, and creating a children's trauma center up in Anchorage.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really good to know.
Just as far as I think it's obviously already a resource, but growing into a bigger and bigger resource for up north, which is pretty awesome.
You know, a lot of folks, I would think, would have the symptoms of trauma, but not recognize that those symptoms are trauma caused. For example, migraines or chronic fatigue or flashbacks, flashbacks certainly, PTSD, fibromyalgia. Could those physical issues be trauma caused?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That kind of brings us back to that earlier point we were kind of explaining, dysregulation in the nervous system. And when we're living in trauma physiology and survival physiology, it taxes our physical bodies. Like we're not meant to have those stress hormones coursing through our bodies all the time. So chronic fatigue, migraine patterns. There can be, patterns are just really interesting, right? Like we just, our systems figure out ways of setting up a pattern to manage the energy that's in our system. And that can be a migraine pattern. It can be a, digestive disorder. Digestive disorders are very common.
What about
with early trauma?
What about eating disorders?
Also, for sure, yeah.
Definitely. I mean, talk about somatic.
Right, yeah, and I'm sure in your practice you saw a lot
right.
of that. Yeah. But even more on the realm of what we think of as, like, physical symptoms, like stomach aches and irritable bowel system.
Yes.
Yeah, and, yeah, like, things going on with our gut symptoms.
And sometimes don't we somaticize literally? I'm thinking with back pain, like the weight of the world is on your shoulders. Because as I understand it, back pain is kind of a modern symptom. That it's maybe highly related, maybe highly psychological. Not that you're making it up. Mm-hmm. It's just the pain is there. But due to stress, and I'm talking about chronic back pain, people who are really suffering from chronic pain.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's certainly an argument to most of the symptoms that we're talking about are due to modern civilization.
Modern civilization.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, it'd be interesting for anybody in our audience, for example, who may have any of these physiological issues from migraines to phobias.
Mm-hmm.
Where they do not ever connect it to something that happened to them earlier in their life. They may have poo-pooed it and said, oh, that's not a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And also, medical trauma can end up like that as well. We're very We're very nonchalant about how many surgeries we have in modern day. And that puts a lot of stress on our system. We don't like people cutting into us, no matter what drugs we have, right, to numb the pain. So people can develop big anxieties or have symptoms that sort of show up after a medical procedure, and the medical procedure might have been a success and things are fine, but it can have that point of dysregulating the system, right, where the system went into fight flight but couldn't do either of those things because it's under anesthesia and it can't move, and so none of those protective motor programs can play out, and so things get stuck. Dysregulation it's easy to come by. And again, you know, we were talking earlier about just like how we as a society sort of conceptualize what trauma is, and like, oh, my childhood was fine, I didn't have any trauma. You know, it's like, yeah, it could have been fine, and that's great. But, you know, if you fell off the roof, and even though you survived and everything was fine, that might actually really still be affecting the overall functioning of your system now. And, you know, it could be playing a role in your migraine pattern or in your depression or in your anxiety.
So then obviously when a client of yours comes in, they don't need to know if a trauma occurred. They just would be seeking support or healing from the symptom.
Right.
And then therefore they don't need to talk about the trauma necessarily. They don't need to tell the story.
Not necessarily. Sometimes that's an important piece for people to have, you know, a constructed narrative that makes sense to them. And it really depends on who the person is and what's happened and, you know, what kind of explorations they're interested in doing. But for sure, often there is no story, you know.
What does a healthy, balanced nervous system look like? I mean, how would one be?
I don't know. Introduce me to one, would you?
Okay. Well, I peeked on your website, and it said resilient to stresses. I think.
Oh, good. Yes.
Okay. Yes. I'm going to quote from you. It may help to think of our nervous system as infrastructure. A good infrastructure yields less damage when hit if it is well developed, whole and inclusive. It is resilient to stresses. Resilience is what we want. Resilience is the capacity to not get stuck. Do you know, this is very interesting. I'm very interested in neuroscience and the impact of meditation on the brain. And so I'm sure you've read a lot of these studies, but there's a quality that is called stickiness. And stickiness is that something happens to you and you can't let it go. You worry about it beforehand, it happens, and you can't let it go. So at the famous neuroscience lab at the University of Wisconsin, Richard Davidson, who's like the key researcher, he brought in a bunch of Tibetan monks who were, we would call them, professional meditators. And they compared them to subjects, normal subjects like you and me. And they put a heat cuff on their arm. And the heat cuff was very painful but not harmful. I mean, you didn't like it, okay? It's a cuff that got really hot. So then everybody got to try it and see what it felt like. Well, the stickiness was super evident in normal people like me. So what would happen is they said, okay, we're putting the heat cuff on, and then I get all anxious and all my heart would beat. And then after it was over, it took me a long time to go down to baseline to self-regulate. The monks know. They neither got anxious, nor did they spend a lot of time self-regulating. So I think that's what we're, you know, coming with. That's a stress, and it's coming back to self-regulation, which is really emotional balance, emotional stability. And it's the physiological aspect of that you're talking about, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the self-regulating piece is, It's really great when your nervous system is actually doing that for you and you don't have to, you know, do all the tricks to regulate yourself.
You're on autopilot. But, yeah.
Yeah.
We're almost done with our program. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would just add on about that ruminating quality of the stickiness. That's also, you know, that's one of the principles of how we understand trauma, where it's that concept of if it comes at us too much, too soon, too fast, there is a sort of fragmentation that takes place. And that fragmentation is just the loss of relationship. And you can think of it between like the positive and negative ions. Like everything in our system has a relationship, right? And when we have the trauma impact our system, we have this little fragment happen. So we sort of break apart. There's a fragmentation that happens, a loss of relationship. And that ruminating quality, that stickiness that we worry about it, we think about
we
play it over and over and over and over again in our head, that's a piece of our system trying to reintegrate, right? It's trying to get it to re-relate.
Oh.
So things that are, you know, it sounds like you were privy to a study that had that on a really, really low end of the spectrum, right? Like that heat cuff was not traumatizing.
Right. Right. Unpleasant.
It was unpleasant. But there's a piece of that ruminating quality where we replay things over and over again. And that's part of nervous system dysregulation. When the system is regulated and regains relationship with one another, things can move through. That's that resilient quality, right? Like the thing happened, pushed me down, it was stressful, but it's fine. I get up, I carry on, I think about other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, versus getting really stuck.
I think that's a perfect end point because it really sums up where we want to go, where we all want to be.
Yeah.
And I would love to have you, I wish we had another hour, but I want to thank you, Megan Nigro, for sharing your knowledge and your clear compassion for those who suffer from trauma. Thank you for coming into the show tonight. And thank you very much to Dolly and John Kremers, who have been engineering for this show since time immemorial. So to our K2 audience, thank you for tuning in. And please join us on another Monday evening at 7 p.m. next month for another edition of Mind Over Matter. Good night.